This week on Lunchbox Envy, collectively, the ones we farm weigh three times more than all the other birds in the wild put together.
In 2016, KFC released a special edition sun cream that smelt like it.
And in the early 20th century, some of them had to wear glasses.
It's a second helping of chicken. Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Jack and I'm here with my fellow QI elf Manu. We're also here with cook and food writer Ed Smith. How you doing, Ed?
I'm very well, thanks for having me.
Oh no, it's a pleasure. So this is our first revisit to a topic we've done before, isn't
Second
helpings. And we thought we'd get an expert in. So Ed, do you regard yourself as a chicken expert?
For the sake of this program, absolutely. I'm a food writer, cook. I've been doing this for about 15 years after I once being a corporate lawyer. I left that in search of trying to find a stable life in food. Whether I've achieved that, I don't know.
And of course you've written a book all about chicken.
That's right,
chicken
I suppose recipes. That is the reason you might think I'm an expert today. I have written five cookbooks. This is my fifth, Peckish, which is a cookbook entirely devoted to chicken.
Can I say that's a great name?
Thank you very much.
Also very beautiful. Yeah. The cover is lovely. Which is how you should judge a book.
Well, I mean, don't look at the inside, just start with the cover and put it on your shelf. In all honesty, this follows the previous one, which is called Good Eggs. Solve that perennial question. Yes, the eggs came first in this instance.
Do you have a favourite recipe in the book?
Favourite recipe? I found it hard to not just roast a chicken and cook a schnitzel. I went beyond those for a whole chicken, and when I went beyond that for a chicken breast, I quite enjoyed seeing what I could get to. I think breast meat is pretty boring. I used to think that, but bashing them thin, cooking them with masala, Italian old dish, doesn't take more than 10 minutes to cook. It's on your table and you feel quite smug at the end of it.
Yeah.
Delicious. How do you feel about raw chicken sashimi?
Oh, chicken sashimi. Mm. Is that a thing?
Yeah. I've just come back from Japan actually, and it was an option.
No way. Did you go for it?
No.
What?
It was an option in a restaurant that didn't look like it was an option that it should have been.
Oh, yeah. I see.
I've probably eaten raw chicken accidentally.
Right, yeah.
I suspect the reason why we don't eat raw chicken is because of salmonella and other sort of bits of chicken. But typically, that's actually quite a low risk, particularly in modern farming, British farming. You don't have the standards in farms that mean that you need to worry quite as much as people do.
And actually, I read that more people get food poisoning from vegetables because they treat them with less respect. I think when you've handled raw chicken, you always go and wash your hands because you're so scared of salmonella.
Don't need to wash chicken, though.
No?
No.
That's good to know.
That's one of the few things that the Food Standards Agency, I think, is right on. Right. Chicken. They say the reason for that is if there is a risk, it's that you spread the bacteria around your sink.
Yeah,
for splashes. And then the vegetables that you're not bothered about, drag them over there. That's the danger of washing the chicken.
Have you been stung by the Food Standards Agency? I noticed you said one of the few things
I'm not quite with them on the temperature you need to cook chicken to. Which I think is too high. They say, I think, I can't remember, 72 or 74, but at that point, that's why people have breast meat that's dry and fibrous and like sticks in your mouth, and
because
all the protein is already denatured. And so you don't need to cook it that
way. Is your perfect, maybe not FDA proof?
I feel like this is really
don't tell the food standards.
Well, if I was roasting a chicken, rather than cooking it above 70 degrees, which is the kind of number that people have in their heads, I will pull it out when the breast meat is about 66, 67, because it rises. It continues to rise.
It keeps cooking.
And it'll hold at that temperature, and it will be safe, and it will not be overcooked.
That is a top tip.
Beautiful.
But maybe don't try.
Don't sue me.
At your own risk.
Yeah. Yes. Is it true that it's quite a good test of a new chef, to basically make them roast a chicken, because it's sort of deceptively simple?
I think that quite a lot of people concentrate on the flavours, the marinades, and making a recipe really exciting with those things. But when actually you want the chicken to be cooked right, always start with a good chicken. That's probably the easiest way to get there.
That is smart. Yes, I noticed actually in supermarkets, you've always got a few tiers of chicken. And expensive ones, like three times as expensive as the cheapest one. I mean, that's the other thing is, if you have a cheap chicken and then you roast it, it kind of tastes of nothing. Whereas if you get one that's sort of lived a life,
I always think it tastes, I don't know, you can't chicken. Be too preachy about food and the cost of food, but a commercial grade chicken, the really cheap ones, taking about 35 days to grow. Yeah, like, that's why they're cheap. They're basically like obese teenagers. Yeah. And they've got bones that are really thin. Whereas a nice free-range chicken slowly, that might be like live twice as long, develop slowly, and will taste better.
Yeah.
This makes me want to eat a really old person now versus obese.
We do our cannibalism episode.
Yeah. Why do some of those more expensive, more mature, beautiful chickens, why are they yellow? Because I swear I've seen like a lot of kind of more orangey.
Corn feeding.
Yeah. Yeah, which actually sometimes might not be the better chicken. It might be, but corn is the kind of thing that bloats the stomach in a cow. Like you get the fat in cows with corn feeding in America.
It's like a cheat code.
Yeah.
What I regard as the king of chickens is a poulet de presse. Have you heard about these?
Ooh,
they're bred to be white feathered, and they've got obviously the red face and coxcomb. And then they've got blue legs, so they basically look like the French flag. They've been selectively bred, but they're apparently delicious. I haven't tried one.
Yeah, no, they're amazing. They also typically come with a head on, so you've got to be, like, lots of squeamish.
Wow. I remember considering buying one at university because I was a pretentious guy who saved all his money for like interesting food dishes. But they were about £25, and I was like, oh, I don't think I can afford it. I looked yesterday and they're 55 now. I wish I'd done that now.
Yeah, you've missed out.
Just talking about kind of the love of chickens and like beautiful French chickens, did you know that chickens also think we are beautiful?
Oh,
or some of us are beautiful.
Yeah, I was gonna say not all of us.
No. They have really strong preferences for symmetrical faces.
Really?
There was a fantastic paper released in 2002 by a bunch of Swedish scientists, and they basically trained a group of hens and cockerels respectively to peck at pictures of female and male faces. Don't know why it was so heteronormative. 2002, no idea what's going on.
Famously no homosexual chickens.
No, absolutely not. Anyway, so they got them used to like identifying male or female faces, pecking at them.
And sorry, pecking's meant to be a sign of affection.
Yeah, just like, oh, I recognise that.
So they weren't ripping the face apart.
Yeah. No, it was affectionate.
Like we got panthers to tear apart pictures of people they liked.
Anyway, so they were pecking, and then they introduced different kinds of faces. So some were more or less symmetrical.
Okay.
And they found that the chickens preferred to peck on the more symmetrical faces, were kind of grossed out a little bit by the wonky ones. And I have an image here of the face spectrum. Apparently these two in the centre.
The ones in the middle are symmetrical.
Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that the chickens like the most. And they tested them against a group of university students who didn't need to be trained. They just picked their favourite faces. And a very similar result.
Okay.
So yeah, chickens like hot people.
So basically we can replace students with chickens, is that what you're saying? Okay. The etymology of chicken, apparently it comes from Old English, and it's onomatopoeic. It's the noise they make. Chick, chick, chick,
chicken.
And hen comes from chicken, presumably.
Well, the German word for chicken is henchen, so that's a small hen.
Ah, I see. I was also looking at the origin of the word hen party, because I was like, obviously that's connected. Apparently it might not be.
Really?
It's from an old word hinny, which is like honey or sweetie, rather than chicken at all.
Oh, because Scottish people, I've heard Scottish people refer to, you know, like, oh, you wee hen.
Oh,
what are you having for your tea?
Oh, like I said, that was the honey bit.
Also have chicken pox.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. First off, chickens cannot get chicken pox.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Can Germans get German measles?
Oh, okay.
Imagine if they were immune.
So they can't get our human strain, but they can get fowl pox, and it causes similar kind of dry, itchy, disgusting sores.
Okay.
And yeah, there are two theories. So one is to do with the fact that it's quite a mild, non-fatal disease.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1755, the OED cites an example. It's of no very great danger from the mildest of disease. So it's called chicken pox because it's
because it's pathetic. Yeah.
Don't be a chicken.
Exactly.
I also read that there's an old English word, jikan, which means itching. So that to me is the most likely.
That does make a lot of sense.
Jikan pox.
Mm-hmm. Another idea that it comes from the word chickpea, because the sores look a little bit like chickpeas.
Big ones.
Big,
well, small ones.
Chickpeas.
Big sores, small chickpeas.
But there was a clinical pharmacologist at Oxford called Geoffrey Ironson, who wrote an entire article about the etymology of chickenpox. Big nerd. And he was like, well, this is obviously not true, because before chickpeas were a thing, it was becoming chickenpox.
Oh, right. So, the timeline doesn't work.
Exactly.
Pre-Ottolenghi.
Okay, it's time for our first lunchbox, and this week that's Ed's. What have you brought, Ed?
I have brought a lesser used part of the chicken, chicken livers, which I've mixed.
Oh, livers, okay, right. I was worried you were going to say feet.
I'm so scarred by this podcast. I thought you were going to say, like, eyeballs or the beak.
Chicken livers, I think it's one of the more approachable bits of offal in a chicken. Plenty of it in the supermarket, really cheap, really nutrient dense. But I've chucked it in with some tofu, made a kind of mapo tofu, but with chicken livers.
One of my favourite dishes.
So good.
I'm excited.
Is that the Sichuan-y?
Exactly, thingy? Yeah. Tingly, spicy, a little bit earthy. Nice. And the kind of chicken livers are quite approachable as far as livers go. They are slightly metallic, I think, in taste, but not nearly so much as a bigger animal. Nice. Well, I think more like earthy and savoury and a bit
quite
creamy.
Sweet as well.
They go really well with sweet things or with sharp things. So like in a salad, you'll typically get like a really aggressive dressing or pomegranate molasses, and chicken livers is really good with sumac. So that's really good. Nice.
Yeah.
We can go really kind of spicy, which is kind of in line with what we've got here.
Yeah.
Chicken livers, I always think they're surprisingly big given the size of a chicken. If you're cooking it, I might slice them in half. I'll use a reference from your first episode on chicken.
Ooh,
not dissimilar to the size of a chicken oyster if you cut them in half. So you've got these kind of things that you can cook quickly and fast enough to char and brown the edges, but in the middle they're slightly pink. That's how you do it in the salad.
Perfect. That's
just serve incredible. It up.
Should we dig in? Yeah.
Yes, please. That's really good.
Oh, good. In Peckish, what I tried to do was to order it according to the way in which we buy chickens and how it's packaged in the supermarkets. And that meant there is a chapter on what I kind of called the lesser bits, chicken mince, chicken wings, and chicken livers.
Right, I don't know if I've seen chicken mince in a supermarket.
Oh, I have.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah, it was one of my revelations, actually, when like sort of trying to do the book, is how good chicken mince is.
Wow.
So enjoyed that. But with the chicken livers as well, I kind of thing that helps to... If you chop it up, put it in a ragu, like a classic bolognese, it's got a kind of a creamy texture. You know, when some meat gets really dense and tightens up, chicken livers, they are kind of softer and creamier. And I think that's, along with their richness and earthiness, and probably the fact that they're like cheap. It's a good thing to add to a ragu, or you can have it in and of its own in a salad.
It was one of my favourite things that my grandma used to cook, who's dead now, but she was from Mauritius. They use like so much vinegar in Mauritian cuisine when they cook chicken livers or like octopus. It's nearly pickled.
Right.
But the sweetness of it, it's so good.
Yeah. I mean, chicken livers are often the kind of thing that's seen as a humble sort of peasant cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Save for probably chicken liver pate, which is probably mimicking foie gras, really.
Do you think it could be dessertified? Is it sweet?
Oh my God.
No, because it's creamy and it's sweet.
A little mousse, yeah. I think a similar thing is the... What's the Italian blood chocolate dessert?
Oh, yes. Sanguinaccio dolce.
Which has that ferrous metallic taste to it, and then the chocolate. So maybe a chocolate mousse with chicken liver.
Ooh.
Maybe I wouldn't eat that.
Give it a go.
Maybe that's book two.
So how about another classic dish, the roast chicken?
I've given lots of different ways, different marinades and stuff to have chicken, but fundamentally, like, one of the best ways you can eat chicken is just to simply roast it right. And I don't think overcomplicating it is often necessary. So the thing to do with the roast chicken is, well, the three things to think about. Start with a good chicken.
Mm-hmm.
Don't roast it nearly as long as it says on the packet. Very rarely will you ever need to cook a chicken for longer than an hour.
I've noticed that.
You buy a supermarket chicken, it will say like an hour and a half. Yeah. It's insane.
They're covering their bases.
Mum, listen up. It is not low and slow. It is not low and slow. Like 5 hours. I kid you not.
Whoa, for a chicken?
No way.
Oh, should she do like 100, like very, very...
Like super low.
Just to let the bacteria develop.
Yeah, you know, just like a bit of more funk.
Yeah, so... Cook it fast. I think typically I will cook at about 200 degrees in the oven for rarely more than an hour, probably 50 minutes to an hour, depending on the size of the chicken. And then after the quick cook, a long, gentle rest for 15, 20 minutes, it will categorically make your chicken's juicy and succulent, which, you know, for all the flavours you throw at it, you want to have a nice...
Is that just all of the moisture kind of redistributes around the chicken?
Exactly, while all the fibres relax. If you cut meat that has not been rested long enough, then all the juices will come out and you've got a dry chicken. But it sort of that helps to redistribute it, the muscle fibers relax.
If you massaged a chicken before you roasted it,
whilst it's alive,
are we back on sexy chickens?
We can go there. But no, like theoretically,
I think maybe if the chicken's relaxed when it's killed, it's probably the point at which. So yeah, maybe a gentle massage just before you put a bolt through it.
Cool. It's not quite massaging, but I was making a chicken schnitzel, I suppose, and you had to flatten the chicken. So I just wonder.
Not a massage.
Just whacking it. But I just wondered what the reason for doing that is.
What you're doing is you're creating a piece of meat that's the same thickness all over, so it cooks at the same time. It also is very thin. So, you know, a schnitzel, if you were breading it and then deep frying it in the kind of Austrian way, or if you're pan frying lots of butter, it really doesn't take very long. It's like, it's essentially how quickly can you get those crumbs golden brown? Because by the time that's happened, the chicken's cooked.
That's
like it's 2 to 3 minutes maximum in a pan.
Yeah.
I wonder sometimes whether whoever invented the schnitzel was also trying to make something that looked really big. So when they were selling it in the pub.
Look at this dinner plate sized piece of chicken.
The size of my head. And then it's,
And going back to your oven at 200 degrees, because Rosie was like, she only cooks with a fan oven.
Yeah, same.
Is it okay? So this must be like
it's frustrating when you submit recipes to a magazine who frequently will remove the reference to fan because they think that all people cook on the conventional.
Yeah.
I mean, if you do that, I feel like nothing happens.
I conventionally imagine that the fan oven is like a fancy extra step that you might not use, so that I should just stick to the default.
If anyone doesn't use the fan setting, it feels insane to me.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah.
Okay, it's time for our second lunchbox, and this week that is yours, Manu. What have you brought?
Today I have brought...
Oh my God.
A chicken wearing a bra and sunglasses. I brought a chicken in a bra because putting chickens in bras is how a group of scientists figured out they're actually a lot more intelligent than we give them credit for.
I mean, those fastenings are very tricky, and I find...
I still am.
I regard myself as an intelligent man. But.
So they do have quite tiny brains relative to body size. It's about the size of a large peanut or a small walnut, but they are not stupid. So research has shown that they can count from quite a young age. So chicks can count. They can pass delayed gratification tests. So, you know, like the don't eat that marshmallow in front of you. If you wait, I'll give you two marshmallows.
If you rest for 20 minutes, you'll be extra tasty. Yeah.
And they have a really wide range of vocalizations. Researchers at the University of California found they had at least 24 different sounds that they make to communicate with each other. And they can communicate quite abstract concepts. So they'll have...
it's really hard to not be trying to make chicken noises right
now. Yeah, I mean, go for it. Probably has the music. So if there is an eagle approaching up ahead, for example, coming from quite far away, they have a really high-pitched E.
Eagle!
That they'll screech to each other that attracts enough attention on the ground so that they can run away, but doesn't reach the eagle in the sky. And they all know what that means. And if they're clucking really loudly or squawking, that's for ground predators. Okay. That's like, oh my God, we need to move now. They already know we're here. There's also a that is a male communicating to a female, like, I've got some food, you should come over here, check it out. Shall we have sex?
Do they always ask?
I hope so. Anyway, so this is part of something that males do called tit-bitting. Alpha roosters will kind of twitch their heads rapidly from side to side and kind of bob them up and down and make this dock-dock noise.
Okay.
And that's to signal, like, food, come to me. I will give you
food. That's how I met my wife.
I mean, it does work. So in order to understand more about this chicken language and flirting and power structures, there were researchers at Macquarie University in Australia.
Okay.
Basically created something they called Chicken Big Brother, where they rigged an aviary with loads of high definition cameras and put microphones everywhere to study what these chickens were doing without researchers being actually in the area they were in, because they got freaked out. So they found out that even though there was like quite a strict like alpha male, subordinate males, and the alpha was the one that was doing this kind of tidbitting display, with the Big Brother cameras, they found that other male subordinate ones were actually doing like a silent version. So they were looking at females and doing the like head bobby thing, but not making the noise because they didn't want to attract. No, they didn't want to attract the attention of the alpha male, so they're doing like a. So that was Chicken Big Brother number one.
Okay.
Chicken Big Brother number two.
Big Brother's little brother
is where the bra comes in.
Okay.
Because they were like, "This is fantastic. We've got loads of good data, but it's actually quite hard to hear them from these mics that we've rigged,
especially the silent ones."
Yeah. So what they did was they made little chicken backpacks out of bras, which they hid microphones in.
Wait, human bras?
Yeah, human bras, which they modified. And then they picked up even more weird information. Basically,
the chickens were all saying, "Why have I got a bra on my back?"
They learned the chicken word for what the fuck.
Actually, one of my favorite things is that bras for chicken is a legitimate thing that exists in the world. It's if chickens have a crop that's too swollen, so that's the place, the kind of intermediary bit where they store their food, it can become really pendulous and uncomfortable. So you can buy chicken bras on Etsy, and they are very cute.
Is it a mono bra? It's just got one.
It's literally just one big cup, and it's got a strap in the back. Anyway, so
I know what I'm getting my wife for Valentine's Day.
So what they found out was cockerels are even more devious than they previously thought.
Wow.
So not only were they doing this silent tidbitting thing, they were setting each other up to be attacked by eagles.
Wow.
So they
weren't shouting eagle.
So they were, but what they'd do was they'd hide in a bush and then wait to see when their rival was out, and then they'd call, like, eagle, but not a quiet one, like quite a loud one, in order to attract the eagle, so that hopefully they didn't get everyone killed, but they might get their rival killed.
Oh, wow.
And this is
so devious.
Yeah, quite a complex way of thinking. It's a strategy called risk compensation, and humans do it too. So it's kind of like people driving faster when they're wearing a seatbelt because they feel safer. So they felt safer in the bush, so they'll screech louder. And apparently humans also do it when they're riding bikes.
Yeah.
People wearing cycle helmets are more likely to cycle dangerously.
Huh? Yeah, and aren't you more likely to crash your car on the streets near your house because you feel familiar and you're like, I know what I'm doing. Risk compensation. Yeah. I didn't know there was a phrase for it.
Yeah.
Wow, those devious chickens.
I know. Oh, yes, the glasses.
Talk me through them.
So nothing to do with research. This is more to do with preventing chicken death and chicken cannibalism.
Okay.
So in the early 1900s, so they're called eyeglasses for chickens, and they are to stop chickens pecking each other's eyes out.
Whoa.
Which does happen if they're kept too close to each other under not very good conditions and they're hungry or angry.
Okay.
They'll start turning on each other. In the original photos, they're kind of like red little glasses, and they've got it's actually really horrible. They've got like a spike that goes through the beak.
Ooh.
So they're kind of like
pince nez, except like pierce nez.
Yeah. Anyway, so they did really well. So well, in fact, that in 1910, someone
they sold really well.
Yeah, they were quite popular at one time. And in 1910, they did so well that one of the people who were trying to promote this technology, tiny glasses, wanted it to be a legal requirement in Kansas for all chickens to wear them. Didn't go through.
No.
But you can still buy these today. Much more humane. They're just like little clippy-on ones, and they're made of plastic. Because chickens attacking each other under these conditions is still a really big problem.
Yeah, they take the beaks off and lots of...
It's so horrible.
They clip them. So yeah, glass is better.
So yeah, that's the chicken in the bra with glasses.
Well, I'm glad you had a proper explanation. Otherwise,
I'm not going completely insane. On pecking orders...
Oh,
social structures. The term pecking order, which we kind of use to mean like who belongs where in the social group, that is very literally from the pecking order in farms, on poultry farms.
Really?
So it was developed by a Norwegian scientist called Thorleif Schjelderup Ebbe.
That sounds good.
I'll take it. Who was obsessed with the chickens on the farm where he was growing up. And he spent a really long time getting to know them, studying them.
Taking their bras off.
Anyway, so he realized that there was some kind of like very distinct social structure in the groups. There'd be like a kind of alpha chicken that would be able to peck another chicken, And then that chicken would be able to peck the chicken below it, but not the one above it.
It couldn't go up.
Yeah. Ah. But it was actually a little bit more complex than that because some of them form triangles. So, yeah. Like, basically just a really defined social structure of pecking.
In a non-aggressive way or in like a...
Like an aggressive way. So not like a, oh, I'm going to kill you.
Not like a peck on the cheek.
No. Like a peck off.
But it was like, oh, get out of my space. So he then took his childhood investigations to university, wrote a thesis on it, and now it's become the basis of like dominance theory, wow. And dominance hierarchy all over the world.
Yeah. Chicken law.
Yeah, pecking order. In Norwegian, it's hacklist.
Hacklist.
Yeah.
Well, chickens are very aggressive. Cockfighting was Britain's national sport until 1835. Yeah.
Oh, that's really horrible.
In 1835, it was banned. Yeah, apparently every village would have at least one cockpit.
Wow.
And that's where the word comes from, the cockpit. I think it's partly because they will actually fight to the death with very little encouragement. Mm-hmm. Like if you put one, a very aggressive rooster in with another, they won't start until they're that. But yeah, honestly, like the breeding, the lineages went down in history.
That's also the thing, like how aggressive they are depends on the breed. Because these cockfighting chickens, or like game birds, I think they're called, generations and generations of aggression have been bred into them. Researchers actually found the gene for aggression in these chickens, and it's like crazy high compared to
off the scale.
Yeah.
So number 10 Downing Street, until 1835 when it was banned, had a cockpit in the garden.
Oh yeah,
really?
Yeah, for the Prime Minister to play with his cocks. Time for our third and final lunchbox, and this week that is mine. I've brought you guys your futures.
Oh, my future.
I'm going to read your future in chicken liver. So I've got a bowl of raw chicken livers.
You've really prepared this for us. Thanks so much.
And this is a very ancient method of divining the future called haruspicy.
Ooh, great word.
Yeah, it's really great good. Word. I will be your haruspex, the one who discovers the future, spelled with an X.
You know when sometimes you are telling someone what you do and I feel like I've got a bit of a weird job?
Yeah. What do you
imagine being that guy?
I read chicken portents, yeah. So the earliest reference I found to chicken livers in particular were the Etruscans. So they're the people who was living in what is now Italy, but before the ancient Romans. So we're talking first millennium BC, i.e. like 900 BCE to zero, basically. But the practice of livers more generally goes back. We found models of sheep's livers from ancient Babylon, which is 1600 years before. More generally, the term for divination with chickens as a whole is electromancy, which is another great word. So there's a guy in ancient Greek myth called Electrion, and he was a soldier who was working for Ares, the god of war. Uh-huh. And Ares was like, I'm going to sleep with Aphrodite in this room, but like, don't tell anyone because it's an illicit affair. So Electrion was in charge of guarding the door, but he fell asleep. So then Helios found out and was angry. So he basically turned Electrion into a cockerel so that he would never let Helios sneak up on the people of Earth ever again. That's why the cockerel crows at the coming of dawn.
To save you from your illicit affair.
So Electrion is now the Greek word, or the ancient Greek word for chicken. Anyway, electromancy. I wanted to do some for you today. There are different ways you can use a chicken. So the ancient Greeks used to put a chicken in the middle of a circle of letters, and then you'd put an equal amount of corn on all of the letters. And then the chicken would, it's like a Ouija board, but they would spell out a message.
Great.
And there are various tribes in Myanmar and Thailand that use bamboo splinters that are poked through chicken bones, and they sort of cast them like dice, and it's about the angle that they land at. You can tell your fortune. Another interesting one I noticed, there was a lot of electromancy in ancient Rome, and there was a Roman general in 249 BC called Publius Claudius Pulcher, and he had his chickens thrown overboard when they refused to wish him a good victory, basically. So they got the diviner, the Pularius in Latin, the Roman equivalent of the haruspex. Anyway, it was common practice that before an important event, you would test a chicken to see if, you know, you would get an auspicious victory or an embarrassing defeat. And the chickens refused to peck the food, which was a sign that, you know, he's headed for defeat. So he had them thrown overboard.
That's fair enough, I think.
saying, if they won't eat, perhaps they will drink.
Ugh.
I know. Anyway, he lost 93 Roman ships and was defeated embarrassingly.
Well, so they were right.
And when he arrived, yeah, exactly. So he arrived back in Rome and he was heavily fined for being impious because he'd thrown the holy chickens into the river.
I see.
So would you like me to read your futures?
Go for it.
Whoa. Okay. So I'm seeing two different colours. It's quite healthy and red on the front. It is quite split, so there might be like a big decision coming your way. Oh, look, there's a bit of sinew in there. Tough times, but they're surrounded by a lot of moistness and fleshy good times. Bountiful. It's a very big liver, so you're in for a big bounty.
Okay, so I'm getting...
Am I selling it
to you? I need to make positive. A decision and also bad times and good times.
Yeah, as most fortune tellers will tell you, life is full of good and bad.
Edge.
Oh, this is your liver.
This is the one you were going to choose.
This is pretty. Okay. You've got a very smooth liver, which implies you've got a very smooth time ahead of you.
Excellent.
And there's a big white streak on the back.
Yeah. I think that's sort of fat, isn't it? That bit.
Okay.
So like, where's the sinew on Manny's one, whereas I've got a bit of fat to trim off.
Yeah, you've got to lose some weight, Ed.
True story. Didn't need to look at the liver for that.
So more generally, archaeologists are often finding examples of, they're kind of like training livers. There'll be models carved out of stone or wood. Mm. Here's what to look out for in your livers. And I've got one, a picture of one here.
What?
And so it's quite complex. And it looks like a map. I think it's written in ancient Greek. This is obviously not
so it looks like a
your
festival
first
map.
Yeah, it does end the pyramid stage. This is like Burning Man where they're all wearing this. Oh, that's so funny.
But was it specifically chicken livers?
Often it was a sheep's liver because they were much bigger. You could read a lot more details. Like having a broadsheet compared to a tabloid. But like chickens were much more readily available and it was less costly to kill a chicken because obviously you have to kill it to get its liver. And more portable, you could bring them on ships. That's what happened to poor Publius Claudius Pulcher.
It was interesting because Churchill, as in Winston Churchill, actually predicted the future of chicken and lab-grown meat. So there's a quote from him saying, "We shall escape the absurdity of growing a whole chicken in order to eat the breast or wing by growing these parts separately under a suitable medium."
I mean, what was he doing with the thighs and the drumsticks?
I know, they're the best bit. I don't know if lab-grown is the future. It seems so like...
I think certainly for like just... using the chicken for like a chewy bit of protein if it's in like a curry or deep fried as a nugget.
I mean, in a way, the reason why we eat so much chicken now is because of the speed of growth of the commercial ones, which is kind of like growing them in the lab, isn't it? Like it's basically doesn't taste a chicken and it's there so it can feed the world quickly, cheaply.
What do you think tastes the most like chicken?
I was in Australia last month and I had crocodile.
Oh, really?
And that was very much like chicken mince, actually, texture and taste.
Okay.
I actually cooked your chicken Kiev.
The balls.
Also, yeah, the balls. Ooh. May I say delicious.
Oh, good.
But it got me interested in chicken Kievs generally.
Oh, yeah.
And nobody really knows where they come from, but...
You're going to say not Kiev?
No. I think they probably did come from the Russian Empire, as it was in the 19th century. So there were quite a few French chefs who were like chefs to the Russian royal family. One of them was called Urbain Dubois, or Urban to his mates. His dates are 1818 to 1901, so that's kind of puts him squarely in the 19th century Victorian gentleman. But he spent some time cooking for Prince Orlov, who was an ambassador to Nicholas I. Mm-hmm. He was famous for bringing back service à la Russe.
Oh.
So back in the day, one would eat an enormous meal in a restaurant and it would be service à la Française, which was all the dishes all on the table all at once.
That's good.
It's kind of like a buffet. Yeah, you'd get a lot of food waste.
Do you want the partitioned...
Just a bit more space on the table, really. And also too much choice if you're jumping between these things.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. But it was good for showing off if you had a lot of decadence and like, look what we can prepare. And it also put a lot of choice on the diner because suddenly you couldn't eat it all, so you had to choose which to prioritise. But with service à la Russe, things come one after the other. And then it became much more down to the chef to decide, oh, what's a good thing to follow on? Like, we're restricted. And then it became more of an art of menu writing. And so he also popularised the word chef. which just means boss in French, but it comes from chef de cuisine, mm-hmm. boss of the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And then the chef would be the person who comes up with the menu. Anyway, he had a very early recipe for what basically became chicken Kiev. There's a lot of fricassee de volaille, yeah. mm-hmm. which is basically chicken breast. And à la anglaise is what you say when you basically breadcrumb it and fry it.
Is that? Apparently, I'll take that. I'm lots of
veal
à la anglaise.
Straight back to deep fry, it tastes delicious. Yeah. Good on English.
And then when you did à la maréchal in the Marshall style, ooh. That was like, because Marshall was kind of used as a French word for like an old gentleman past his prime, a retiree basically. And so that was the idea, that this chicken breast would be stuffed and so tender that it would fall apart so someone without teeth could eat it, like a marshal. Anyway, so he had a sort of early proto chicken Kiev recipe, which was basically chicken à la maréchal stuffed with garlic butter. It's him, Urbain Dubois, and a number of other people. So there's Charles Elmé Francatelli and the famous Marie-Antoine Carême. They all visited Russia to spend some time working in Russian kitchens, and then they all sort of invented prototype versions of the chicken Kiev.
Well, good on him.
Yeah.
It's a good dish.
So we have him and Carême and Francatelli to thank for this dish.
What do you think of small plates? He was obviously like...
That was Monsieur the Petit Plate. That's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes and questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
Ed, thank you so much for coming in. Would you like to tell us a bit more about your new book?
Thanks for having me. Peckish is a book full of winning chicken dinners. It was actually a tie-up between the two things, winner-winner chicken dinner or Peckish, but much prefer Peckish. Over 80 recipes, working from wings all the way through to whole chickens and leftovers, and I hope it provides easy solutions to when you get home with your weekly load of chicken in the shopping basket, thinking, what should I do? Should I do the same thing I did last week, or could you look at Peckish and find something different?
And would you recommend one specific recipe just to leave us tantalised?
Well, hard to look beyond the whole chicken. I'm going to say, why don't you spatchcock it, which means flatten it. Cover it in salt, roast it really quickly, but then serve it with some braised peas, spring onions and tarragon and a bit of creme fraiche. Just drench it all the way over the top and it's delicious.
So good, I'm so excited.
For a second lunch now. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Manu Onrio and me, Jack Chambers, with special guest Ed Smith. It was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.